Good morning. Delegates from the National Association of Commissions for Women say goodbye to Hawaii following their week-long national conference. The takeaways include a renewed commitment to the Equal Rights Amendment. We'll talk with Kathy Betts, the executive director of the state's Commission on the Status of Women. Access to care, lodging, and transportation are issues for cancer patients across Hawaii. Jackie Young joins us with proposed remedies. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Mahatma Gandhi was a yoga practitioner as well as a social activist, and Vina Howard is a scholar who studied the link between both sides of his influential life. And musician and Hawaiian practitioner Kuana Torres Kahele talks about the level of research that goes into his award-winning musical journey.
It's Friday, July 22nd. That's The Conversation, and it starts right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation for our Friday. A little Mission Impossible theme going on there.
Yeah, Beth Ann, I'm trying to impart significance to that.
Funny, I was sitting here doing the same thing. Is that a comment on our very first segment this morning? I hope not.
Exactly.
Well, you know, when someone says the Equal Rights Amendment to you, do you immediately relegate that to history, Chris?
Yes.
Yeah, very much so. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the National Association of Commissions for Women really wants to change that. This week, delegates from commissions from throughout the country gathered in Honolulu for a conference where the ERA was one of the first items up for discussion. The group was hosted by the Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women. Its executive director is Kathy Betts, and she's on the line with some of the action items attendees walked away with on their list, especially including the ERA. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here today.
Well, thanks for making time after a very long week, starting on Sunday and ending last night. So as the conference was really getting underway on Monday, there seemed to be renewed fervor for the ERA. Yet for a lot of people, just ask Chris that question, hear that, and many times the thoughts run right back to history and the feminist movement of the 1970s. What came out of the conference regarding the ERA and renewed calls for its passage?
Well, I think we had a lot of really excited advocates from across the country who were really here to connect and find mentors and also mentor younger women and younger leaders. But, you know, I think that they found a renewed sense of optimism to be able to get this work done, to find constitutional protections for women. And that's the problem with the ERA is that we were never able to amend the Constitution to protect women. So that the lack of constitutional protections obviously has a lot of trickle-down effect in a lot of different areas. And you saw on Monday evening with Kamala Lopez here with her film Equal Means Equal, the ways that trickle-down really hurts women and girls across the country.
But a lot of people don't know that, and they believe that, well, you know, women, they're covered. What are we all fighting about?
Exactly. And we have the same discussion with younger women just coming into the workforce when we have to break it to them that actually we don't have paid family leave. Paid maternity, paid paternity, that's not actually something that is in law. So I think that we have to do better education. And part of that really was learning how we can become more relevant for millennials, learning how we can be better mentors to people. When Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor was here in Hawaii a few years ago, she said, every time I reached a new level in my career, I immediately turned around and extended a hand towards a woman who wanted to go there too. And that was so impactful on me, and I realized that I needed to do, even though, you know, I'm a younger person in this career, but I really need to connect with younger women to show them that they can be in positions of power and leadership and make change.
When they're trying to make those changes and trying to be in positions of power, they're still confronted by the statistics that say that women are not truly powerful and that they're not truly protected under the Constitution. So, you know, how do you craft those messages as you're looking to younger women who may have grown up with certain beliefs that aren't true when you know, proved against reality?
Exactly. Well, I think that's why Kamala Lopez's film was so impactful and meaningful for the people there, because she really wants to use film and art and social media as a way to connect with people, which I think is crucial. Social media needs to be the component to move people, and millennials move fast. They're very quick advocates and they're very quick learners because they've kind of grown up in this area of social media. So I think that social media and art is the way to really connect with people.
So how many do you think actually understand that there are two ratification bills in Congress right now?
Probably not many, but that's why we need to do quick education. And I think that the thing that really connects and resonates with younger women is learning about those statistics and seeing that, you know, obviously we have inequity in our school systems, we have inequity in the career, we have inequity in systems response to gender-based violence victims, and that really connects people across the nation. They're able to see that and connect with that emotional story, because I think all women have felt marginalized in some way at some point in their life. You know, it's not a hat we can take off. We'll always be women. So it's something that that really resonated with a lot of the folks at the conference this week.
When we talked to Kamala Lopez last week, you know, her point was that she didn't know about any of this, and she considers herself to be reasonably well-informed, but that in talking to many other women who are in law enforcement, who are involved with advocacy in other ways, they're very siloed and that they don't really seem to have an understanding that even the ERA is still alive.
Exactly, exactly, which means that we need to do better education and outreach. But I think her film is a perfect medium to do that.
I'm not trying to make a commercial for her film, but the mere fact that we can have, really, but the mere fact that we can have so many women who erroneously walk around with certain beliefs about what is or isn't protected and how they may or may not be treated in the workplace, if they happen to be incarcerated, in whatever arena they may choose, that it's still something that needs a whole lot of work. Now, those two bills that are in Congress, those one of them at least is looking at that three-state strategy, because when the ERA ran out of time, which is an issue in and of itself, it was still three states short of the 38 that it needed to be ratified. The three-state strategy is still moving through Congress, and so is traditional legislation to ratify the ERA for this year. Any sense of where that is and how it's moving?
You know, I'm not sure, but I think Kamala's comments on Monday night, she said, whatever strategy, we're here to support you, whatever strategy. And I think giving women the choice on how they want to advocate for their rights is crucial, because so many times our movement gets picked up by other movements, so we do get siloed. Going back to that, though, I think most women inherently know about the lack of protection and our marginalization, but when you pair that with civics education, we need to do a better job in our schools of educating about civics and government, because that's the only system we have. So we really have to put more power into that.
So what was the big takeaway from the conference?
You know, we had a lot of takeaways, and it was wonderful connecting with all of these amazing advocates from across the country. But one thing that stood out to me that resonated with a lot of the women was on Tuesday we went to Iolani Palace, and despite the, you know, vast diversity in all of the women's backgrounds, socioeconomic, age, ethnicity, they really resonated with the Queen's story. They resonated with the story of the illegal occupation and illegal overthrow. And I think they were able to connect that on a female level of feeling marginalized and powerless and trying to do things for your people. So that was very, very moving for a lot of the advocates. So I'm glad that they got that cultural education here, and they're able to learn the Queen story.
So, Kathy Betts, with that experience, what are the, you know, delegates going off to do now as they are all returning to their respective states and homes?
Well, I think one of the focuses was Title IX on in college and higher education. So strengthening Title IX protections for women and students in higher education, also extending greater benefits for mentorship and ways to mentor people. So that was a renewed hope for that. And then also just doing the work that they always do, but with a greater sense of sisterhood and connection to us. So that was a wonderful takeaway.
And perhaps a greater connection to the ERA, too. We'll see what happens with that. Thanks so much.
Fingers crossed.
Thanks so much. We'll talk soon.
Thank you so much, Beth Ann.
Kathy Betts is the executive director of the Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women. It's the catalyst for positive change through advocacy, education, collaboration, and program development focused on quality, on equality for women and girls.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and coming up in the show, the legacy of the Mahatma as a yoga practitioner. But first, your quiz.
With the upcoming Rio Games now about 2 weeks away, today in the Backyard Quiz, we're taking a look at the world of Olympic sports, in particular, the world of competitive swimming. Now, you're likely familiar with Michael Phelps and his incredible performances in Athens, Beijing, and London. He's the most decorated Olympian of all time. Here in Hawaii, many of us are also very familiar with legendary waterman Duke Kahanamoku, known around the world for popularizing the sport of surfing. Duke was also a five-time Olympic medalist. He won back-to-back gold medals in the 100-meter freestyle at Stockholm in 1912 and Antwerp in 1920, as well as gold and silver medals in team relay events. For this morning's quiz, though, we want to know if you can tell us who was Hawaii's first female Olympian. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right walks away with the HPRT.
Aloha, I'm Aiden James from Honolulu. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Mohandas K. Gandhi captured the imagination of the world with the image of a frail little man who was able to move mountains, harnessing a degree of inner strength no one could have anticipated, and in the process, spearheading his country's liberation from British rule. Vina Howard is an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at California State University, Fresno. She's written a book called Gandhi's Ascetic Activism, Renunciation and Social Change. In it, she looks at the sources of that inner strength, and she's with us in our studio this morning. Good morning, Vina.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
It's happy to have you. Most people would immediately come up with a visual image of Gandhi before just about anything else, right?
That's correct.
Seated in a yoga pose and somehow wielding enormous power. What's that about?
Yeah, either yoga pose or spinning his wheel.
Yes, yes.
Right? Apple, Steve Jobs uses that image of spinning
the
wheel.
The loom, yeah.
Right, little old man in his lion cloth. And that image is, you know, to us seem like a little old man, but in India it invokes an image of a yogi, a Mahatma. Mahatma means a great soul. And it's a title. It's not just an honorific title as a doctor or reverend. It is a yogi. It's the one who really tames, really restrains his sensual desires and overcomes his or her passions. And that's a yogi and that's a Mahatma, that great soul.
One might think that taming one's passions would lead to a kind of numbness, you know, moving you away from strength.
Right. And that's the psychoanalyst would say, too. It's almost like repressing it.
Yeah.
But he's not repressing it. In the Indian systems, it's yours. You channel that energy for creative things. Mm-hmm. You become more creative. And because we all have this very innate energy within us, and we can use it or abuse it in certain ways, but you can also harness it and channel it.
So in a way, energy is a sort of a quantum that can be taken from one place to another.
Right.
Fear can become strength.
Exactly. And it's very tangible also. You know, it's a very tangible energy. You know, I always wonder when he stood up in front of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and he will ask these peasants and common Indians, men and women, and to go for a strike, for example, mm-hmm. Or resist the unjust laws. And people will just do it.
And yet placing themselves at great risk.
Risk, right. But why?
Yeah.
In
yeah.
today's world, we say, why should I do it?
Sure.
And what was that? Where did this get this power? Where did you get this energy or charisma, some would say?
It was always described in accounts of the time as a kind of an intangible, right?
Right, right. Yet it was tangible in some ways because people sensed it, right?
You got the result, right?
Exactly. It's a very intangible yet very tangible with tangible results.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So the Indians called him Mahatma around 1915. And he was not very old.
That's way before the world knew about him.
Way before the world knew about him. But in South Africa, he was well known, mm-hmm. what he did in South Africa. And then our poet, Rabindranath Tagore, wrote a letter to him saying that he was what he's doing is not a common human being. It must be a Mahatma, a great soul. And many, you know, Westerners like theosophists, and they recognize in him, or British leaders, something was different. Something is different with this man. And they couldn't put their hands on, their fingers on. It's like you say, it was intangible, but they could feel it.
The superficial judgment, and I think kind of an inaccurate one, be to say he's a holy man. That's not quite it, is it?
Well, we don't have that vocabulary in English, right? Either we have a saint, right? The word saint. Mm-hmm. But the saint, we have a different connotations of the word saint, right? Mm-hmm. The saint Mahatma. Saint, that's what is used as saint politician. Mm-hmm. But the Mahatma carries with it a certain indigenous connotations, mm-hmm. that the person has so much inner power. And you have to read my book for that, is that how he gets that inner power. Mm-hmm. Again, by restraining. Again, the yoga is not simply the discipline of body, the discipline of mind, discipline of senses, discipline of your emotions. Mm-hmm. It's a complete discipline. And that discipline creates power.
It's a looking within to affect life without, is what it sounds like.
That's right. So a lot of time, what happened traditionally in India's history, when you see these Mahatmas, don't go out, become politicians and activists, right? You can't imagine today's world our presidential nominees being yogis and Mahatmas, do we? I wish sometimes.
Not offhand, yeah.
Right? And so, I mean, you can't imagine any being Donald Trump or somebody being celibate.
He's been called many things, but Mahatma is not
right.
one of
or
them,
anyone yeah. else, you know, a politician.
Sure.
So let it be India, too. So, but he was a kind of a very paradoxical combination of a saint and politician, Mahatma and politician.
It sounds as if it all depends on people's ability to sense that inner power
right.
in an almost telepathic manner, that mm-hmm. you see this little guy up there in a loincloth and 5,000 people all at once say, he's got it, I'm going to listen to him.
And don't be sensitive in today. I mean, look at what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. did
sure.
here, and how he sensed that power and brought it to a very different context. And look at Cesar Chavez in our Central Valley in California, mm-hmm. how he used for the farm workers movement. And I think we need Gandhi's model today, don't we?
I think both Dr. King and Chavez would say that Gandhi alerted them to what was possible.
Yes. And then I think what is the power is the inner power and the power of the people that come together. And the leader has to lead. the leader has to have that kind of intangible, I don't know whether I should call it spiritual or not, I mean, yogic in a quotes, that this power mm-hmm. that really concentrated this inner force that shows us what's possible.
So a group of people that has no focus becomes a group with a focus.
That's right.
Big difference.
That's right. I've been in conversation with Reverend Lawson, James Lawson. I don't know whether you know his name. He was in the movement of Dr. King, and he's the one who led the lunch counter sit-ins. He's the one who went to India and brought
that. That's when we really
idea.
Became aware of that kind of power.
Right, right.
And thank you so much. We have to run, but
okay.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Dr. Vina Howard is an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at California State University, Fresno. She'll be giving a talk entitled Gandhi on Yoga in Daily Life and for Social Justice at Honolulu Still and Moving Center, July 31st at 4 p.m. in Honolulu. And you can find out more on our Facebook page.
Back in 1994, on Science Friday, we tried to imagine what robots of the future might look like.
I've heard these stories, you know, all over the years about how, you know, we could make a robot like a squid or something. Well, you know, squids can't drive cars and squids don't work.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, a robot reboot, our new thinking about designing robots, all on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11.
Think about this. It costs $9.15 to run Hawaii Public Radio's statewide network every minute of every day. That comes to $13,000 a day, $92,000 a week. These members understand balancing a budget, and we are infinitely grateful for their support. Ellie LaRue of Honolulu, Angela Morales of Waianae, and Star Lockwood of Kamuela. If HPR adds quality to your life, please become a member of Hawaii Public Radio. You can find us at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is open every minute of every day. And thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting and Sacred Hearts Academy.
Not long ago, we talked about a disease not found in Hawaii, but one that's common in Arizona, including in the prison where Hawaii inmates are housed. Valley fever's effect on these prisoners may soon mean a lawsuit for the state, but for the moment, it won't mean Hawaii will stop sending them to the mainland. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair picks up the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. And just to note, they're cleaning the windows outside the Civil Beat offices here on Waialae. This is live radio, so there may be some audio interruptions. But good morning and aloha Friday.
All right. Well, we'll probably have to just think past those squeegee noises. Now, we talked about this the end of June, and probably a lot of people had never heard of Valley Fever before. So briefly, what is it?
It's an airborne fungal disease. It's common in the Southwest, and it gives you flu-like symptoms. Louis Kanea actually opens his story with a Hawaii inmate who's housed there at Saguaro in Arizona, as we have reported, 1,400 prisoners from the islands there. Well, not only is he experiencing flu-like symptoms, he's also coughing up blood. And what he wants to do is be transferred back to Hawaii, and he's exploring legal action. Well, Louis's article actually inspired a local attorney to file a class action lawsuit, which he's preparing. And he's seeking not only damages, but he would like to have all of our prisoners returned back to the islands. He was inspired directly by this article on Valley Fever.
I mean, all to the good, but A, where are we going to put them? And yeah. B, what about the fact that these prisoners may be coming back with Valley Fever and there's not necessarily expertise here to be able to deal with it? You know, we've had, 6 years of prisoners being out there in Elroy, Arizona, way out there in the Sonoran Desert. we're just hearing about this now. Why do you think that is?
Well, certainly I have to take a little credit for Civil Beat and Louis Kinnea doing the reporting on this, but it's not something that is really, because it's common in the Southwest, in Arizona, people really haven't talked about it. But in California, where it is also in the Southwest, parts of it, there has been lawsuits that have led to two prisons there having to come up with a policy, making sure that prisoners that are getting this disease aren't treated well, or perhaps put in other facilities where they're not exposed to this. So clearly there has been action elsewhere, and it could happen here. But you bring up a good point. Where would we put everybody? We're actually going to be renovating Halava, a prison, later this year, and that's going to mean 250 prisoners have to temporarily be relocated, and that could very well include Arizona. I can tell you the Department of Public Safety, which, by the way, won't comment on the lawsuit until they see it, they are now preparing fact sheets, giving fact sheets to prisoners that are going to Arizona, letting them know, you know, recognize the symptoms of valley fever. But
any testing, you know, for those who are already there, any help for them?
Doesn't appear to be any kind of screenings. That's certainly something that could help a great deal. You know, the gentleman we told you about, Wayne Hunt, when he complained to the Department of Public Safety, they wrote him back and said, you know, you're getting great care in Arizona. The doctors know what they're doing. But in fact, there is concern that people might actually be dying, including the person that we talked about in Louis' last article, a prisoner whose heart attack recently directly linked to valley fever.
Incredibly distressing story, and I know you guys are going to stay on top of it, and we'll talk more about it as it continues to unfold. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Talk to you on Monday. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat. Every day, we bring you a reality check.
My name is Kat Lynn Hurtubise, and I am with Gourmet Events Hawaii. We have been an underwriter for Hawaii Public Radio since 2009. The experience in being an underwriter is just a sense of joining a really warm and powerful family. There are many companies that I admire and respect who are also underwriters, and I feel like I'm in very good company by choosing this year after year.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
Well, here we are on a Friday, a rather blustery day for most of the state. And Bill Dorman, our news director, is in with us to take a look at what we know about the weather and many of the other stories that will be coming out of our newsroom next week. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Beth Ann.
Glad you're in one piece here. People have been blowing in our door all day.
Well, it's Hawaii County, actually, right now, in terms of focus. They are now under a tropical storm warning, which, as you know, means that tropical storm conditions within 36 hours, the winds there, still quite a bit offshore, but around 60 miles an hour. We'll be keeping track of that certainly over the weekend. Jackie Young will be along with updates and tracking that. But it's also, at the same time for seasonal heat and a time when the new school year is about to get underway, August 1st, week from Monday, actually. And that combination brings to mind the question of air conditioning in classrooms and the overheated classrooms. We've been through this. Certainly last year, a lot of discussion in terms of the administration of what to do. DOE is going to be, Department of Education is going to be meeting with contractors later this week, or next week rather, about the bidding process for the air conditioners. And the teachers union also wants to take a broader look at some of these options, including perhaps the approval of heat days, you know, if it just gets to be too much of just taking off from school. And Molly Solomon will be tracking that.
Which is an interesting idea, because clearly if you come from the East Coast, you know about snow days.
Yes, it's true. It's similar related, but it's one of those issues that has some politics attached, and that's also political season as well.
As we well know, what's coming out in that front?
Well, you know, a couple of previews of some political races coming up. We have a mayoral forum next week coming up on this island on Tuesday. The three leading candidates, now there's one poll out there at least, DeJoux, Caldwell, and Carlisle. Wayne Yoshioka is going to be covering that, but he's also starting to take a look at some of the other candidates who are in this race that are not getting a lot of publicity, that are not getting that laser-like focus. And he's looking at sort of their, not just what they stand for and why they are running, but also what they may bring to some of the issues that are under discussion, that whoever winds up being the mayor is going to have to lead the fight against and the policies towards.
Very often it's those folks who really don't have a chance of winning that can drive discussion simply by bringing up things because they don't have a whole lot to lose.
And that's the point in terms of covering politics. It's not just a personality issue. It's also the policies, and the policies for the good of the people, for the voters. And that involves all of us. And that's some of what Wayne's going to be getting to next week.
And in arts and culture?
Polo. Polo in Hawaii, a little bit different than elsewhere. Horses, mallets, all of that, but also slack key guitar, picnics. Noe Tanigao is going to be giving us a bit more detail on that.
Good. Sounds like summer and sounds like fun. Thank you, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. It's a Friday, and that means we read your letters and email and take a look at what's coming in from our talk back line. And this week, we heard this.
Hi, Bethlehem. This is Carla Sachi, the artist over in Kona. I just wanted to thank you so much for Kathy Kozak's show, doing two shows back-to-back that are solving all of my health issues, and I cannot believe it. This is like the most exciting thing that's happened. I feel like I've discovered fire, and I'm so grateful for HPR. I really just really am so grateful that you have such a wonderful radio station that has so many things for people to be educated about, and thank you. Aloha.
Susanna Choi wrote in via Facebook, listened to an interview regarding the current Mamma Mia production at DHT this morning. It got me excited about the show, but when I went to check for tickets, they were essentially sold out for every single show. So what's the point of the interview?
Sorry about that. In response to our interview with Darren Blomquist on the warning signs in the housing market, Rose Darling from Kahului wrote in via Facebook, they really need to reconsider the term affordable when it comes to real estate for locals in Hawaii. It's a virtual massacre here with investors purchasing homes that were originally intended for the workforce, then turning around and renting the properties to locals at top dollar.
Aloha, Ms. Kozlovich. Mahalo for your interest in our little problem that we who live in the southern part of the Big Island are having with an international company wanting to industrialize our rural neighborhood for a quick profit. Thankfully, the consumer advocate is looking into the matter and, like us, has figured out that this sort of thing is not in the public interest. I refer to your excellent interview with Representative Dr. Richard Cregan on Monday morning last week. During your interview, you were trying to understand how a solar project that gives us all nice, green, clean, renewable energy could possibly not be wanted by our town, our island, and our consumer advocate, Mr. Jeffrey Ono. Let me say that our town is not against solar power. This project is way too big. It is utility scale. Our town will look like an industrial site. We don't need the power. We on the Big Island have a surplus of daytime energy, and every day perfectly good clean energy is curtailed or thrown away. We absolutely don't need more of what we already have too much of. We need solar with Aloha and Boston.
Thanks very much for the emails and for the calls. If you'd like to leave us your comments in your own voice, call us on our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Just please remember to include your name and your city if you'd like us to use your letter or call. One of the realities of living in Hawaii is that there are often things you just can't find on your island. While going online to buy what's not in a local store is one thing, finding necessary medical care is much more serious and often costly. For the kind of care that comes with cancer, as with other diseases, getting treatment frequently means travel to Oahu or even the mainland. Although that fact is anecdotally referenced, community volunteer Jackie Young believes most people don't understand the havoc and hardship that causes and why some organizations, including the American Cancer Society, are specifically looking to make it easier. Jackie Young is a two-time cancer survivor, and she's in our studio this morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
When we talk to families with kids with cancer and other families who have gone through cancer who are on Oahu, one of the things they say is, aren't we lucky that we're here? You said that yourself about having gone through cancer twice. But for anyone on the neighbor islands, the idea of having to deal with all the emotional aspects of having cancer and then having to find the kind of treatment and flying back and forth and how enervating that is really becomes enormously difficult to deal with. What are the stats that we know now about how many people have to travel and how many people really have cancer now in Hawaii?
Well, as far as we know, there are about 650 people a year who come from the neighbor islands to Oahu to visit specialists or see doctors or get specialized care. I recently had my second bout of cancer back in October. I had kidney cancer, and I was in the hospital for 5 days. And after I got out, of course, they wheel you to the curb, and then you go home. But if I were from the neighbor island, it would be tough for me to then get on the plane and have to go back home. I would like to have another night of rest in the community before I went home. And that's offered too. You know, we're going to be offering in November Hope Lodge, where people could come and spend the night, spend a couple of weeks, spend a couple of months, because it's going to be free lodging, which has not been offered before in Hawaii. I don't think we even realize how lucky we are to live in Oahu and to be so close to all of the major hospitals.
But that's very difficult for somebody to hear if they're listening on a neighbor island. Oh, you know, another thing that's Oahu-centric, which seems to be the real point of the fact
exactly.
that we haven't dealt with this as being an Oahu-centric issue. We say it anecdotally. People reference it, you know, for the, you know, the 600 or 700 people who have to come here back and forth. And that's not necessarily including the families with kids with cancer. But how do we start to change this movement to where people can get the care on their islands when we already know we don't have enough doctors? We're down some 900 doctors. We know that the whole medical industry in Hawaii, hospitals are going through such transformations. Look at Maui. How do we begin to even approach what a lot of these families who are facing cancer really need?
Well, I think, first of all, they should not put off any treatment or any diagnosis of treatment because they fear that they don't have the money or that they can't get the care. They need to be aware of their bodies. In order for us to save lives, people need to have early detection. That was one of the lessons I learned from my first cancer, which was breast cancer. I delayed getting a mammogram. I thought I was too busy. I didn't even go in for my regular checkups. But when I finally did, because my doctor said she wouldn't refill my prescription that I needed unless I came in for a mammogram, she threatened
leverage.
Me. Yeah, she threatened me that I went in and then discovered that I had cancer. And it was my fault. I was too busy. I put it off. So it's really important that people continue their regular treatments and early diagnosis and check themselves, so that's one of our first preventions, that they follow up and not be worried about the cost afterwards, but follow up and get those screening tests that they need. That's super important.
But going back to the point where if that's not necessarily something that you can get, the kind of care that your cancer, once perhaps it's discovered, necessitates, what's happening throughout the state, not just with American Cancer Society, but, you know, other organizations that are working with specific other diseases, that we know will recognize the fact that there needs to be some greater help for people? I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, Hawaii Public Radio had the radio flyers for
right.
families who are coming to Kapi'olani to be able to be with their children, and it's very costly for a parent or, you know, two parents to have to fly with a child. I mean, but we're starting to slowly understand that this is a family situation. It's not just the person who has cancer.
Exactly. Well, one of the nice things about the American Cancer Society, we do have help 24 hours a day throughout the year by calling 1-800-227-2345. That's a call center that's in Austin. They are trained to understand, to answer all the questions that they may have. If people have insurance needs, if they want to know where the nearest doctor is, they can call that center and they can get that information.
But you mentioned the fact that it's in Austin, the fact that you have to call again to the mainland or reach out someplace beyond where you are. Is there any real movement afoot to be able to, in some ways, better network some of these services and bring them to various neighbor islands and not necessarily have to have people travel to Hawaii? I mean, travel to Oahu as much if they're coming from across the state?
We do have offices. We do have a presence on every island, the American Cancer Society. So we have offices on Kauai, Maui, and in Hilo. And they also refer people to the cancer.org or to the 1-800 number because that's 24 hours.
So what I'm really hearing you say is that no, there really isn't enough.
There isn't enough. Yeah. There's never enough. In fact, you know, we don't have enough regular doctors on the neighbor islands. So, yeah, they will need to come to Honolulu for a while. And this is where our need for transportation is also important.
Well, yeah. we'll be focusing more on that as we just deal with more of the realities of living in Hawaii. Thanks very much for coming in. Glad you're doing well.
Thank you.
Jackie Young is a consultant, advocate, and volunteer for projects and issues that inspire social change. She's also a two-time cancer survivor.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we focused on Olympic athletes and asked you who the first female Olympian from Hawaii was. If you've been to Waimea or Kamauela, our quiz subject's name may be familiar to you. She helped establish and promote the Waimea Arts Council, and each year the council hosts a juried art show in her name. Before this woman found her passion in art, she was a swimmer, and after graduating from Punahou School, she qualified for the U.S. Olympic team. In 1920, she traveled to Belgium for the Antwerp Olympics, the same games where Duke Kahanamoku won his gold medals. And this multi-talented Renaissance woman's athlete was Hilo-born Helen M. Cassidy. And although she missed out on the medal stand, she has a place in Hawaii's history. And thanks to Mark Sakamoto for today's quiz. At 8:47, if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaiian music is filled with stories about places celebrating their beauty, of course, but also evoking their history and their distinct island-by-island character. Kuana Torres Kahele tells stories through his songs that are based on careful research. He'll be telling them in an upcoming HPR concert, and he talked with us about what it means to him.
Hawaiian people, we are very, very in touch with our land. Even on into this age, we never lost sight of that.
Which is remarkable, yeah?
Yeah. And
really
for us, it's important. Mm-hmm. And as a Hawaiian practitioner, I try to raise awareness about that through music.
Sure.
And the mele, the songs that I write, helps give more cultural ties and value to our people. So, for example, when I write a song about Wahiawa or Honolulu, mm-hmm. then the people of that area will hear this song, they will read into the song, read the story, gain cultural knowledge, history, and value from that, and it gives them a deeper connection to the place that they're from.
As history has a way of doing, right?
Yeah.
You know, Wahiawa today is one thing, but,
yeah.
but its history is something quite...
Yeah, so a lot of times through mele, I'm always famous for revealing older names or some kind of information that's not broadly known.
Mm-hmm.
And that always really helps.
Why do you think that's important?
It's important to know... Not the nickname of a place.
Yeah.
But its true name, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, if you look at it that way.
Well, usually the original name reveals something important.
Yeah, it has the story. Every place has a story in Hawaii, every single place, mm-hmm. No matter where you go. And if you can find the real name of the place, the story will present itself.
Which is not always easy, finding
the
real
name. Yeah, it's really hard to do sometimes. And a lot of us, we really have to dig deep to find. The good thing is it's there.
Yeah.
You just got to find it.
Well, digging deep takes on a different meaning when you're talking about an oral tradition, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if you can find an old book and turn the page.
Yeah, it's hard.
So what do you do?
A lot. It depends. It really depends because not all information is found in one place here in Hawaii. So a lot of the times we have to go different places. Sometimes we can go to the library. Sometimes we have to dig through old files from Hawaii State newspapers. Sometimes we have to go super old and look at the old Hawaiian newspapers. And that can be tricky for most if you don't know the language.
Yeah.
Because all of the Hawaiian newspapers were all in the Hawaiian language.
And to me, one of the really remarkable things about the history of the Hawaiian people is going from a non-written tradition to this wholesale embrace of newspapers in the Hawaiian language, you know, a century later, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a remarkable shift, but those newspapers, we're only just starting to see what's in them, aren't we?
Yeah, we're only a lot of us are only starting to just scratch the surface. In the old days, there were a dozen different newspapers.
Yeah, in the Hawaiian language.
In the Hawaiian language. So, some of these newspapers were going for 10, 15 years. Some went 20 years. So there's more publications in one than versus the other, and the great thing about these newspapers is it's all stories. There wasn't much going on back then, so you know they had to go and find something interesting.
There wasn't enough news to generate papers once
a
week.
So these people would go around different islands, and they would just interview random Hawaiian people from here or from there, and just get stories. What is the story about this place that you live in? Why is the name that? All that kind of stuff that we want to know is in the newspaper.
Yeah. Well, it's a logical extension of that, of the pre-existing Hawaiian tradition translated to print is what it sounds like.
Pretty much it is.
Which is a hugely valuable archive.
It is. It's really, really valuable. And through the efforts of a few different bodies of Hawaiian groups, they have been translating and digitizing these Hawaiian newspapers.
Yeah.
And like I said, there's so much. It's been ongoing now for 10 plus years. I used to work for one of those bodies too.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to help translate and digitize the newspapers a few years back. But it's taken a long time. And they're still working at it, but it's finally been made available on the web for people to access.
Well, it certainly is. It certainly argues in favor of Hawaiian language learning, whereas you know it goes against the whole notion of a dead language, right? Where you're actually there is enormous value still to be gained from learning the language. It's given you a lot, hasn't it?
It's given me a lot. It's definitely given me material to be able to write songs for these islands.
Yeah. And your music is really, it seems as if your music is always very much framed within the wider context of your being a cultural practitioner, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's a toss. It all depends. You know, each island has a body and a soul of its own.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm on the island of Hawaii, everything that comes from that cultural, its essence, stories, mainly its essence, that's what creates the album. That's why when you look at all my albums, from Hawaii Island to Niihau to Maui to on over to Kauai, no album are the same. Mm-hmm. They're all original compositions, but if you listen to the overall essence of the album, they're totally different. It's all different characters.
How do you sort of get to the heart of that when you go to Kauai?
I have to immerse myself in the place. How does one immerse themselves into an island? I don't know. You just do it.
You start by going there, right?
Yeah, you can start by going there.
Yeah.
I think what I've been doing, I think you have to be blessed in some sort of a way. I think I've tapped into a spiritual line that allows me a connection with not just my own ancestors, but ancestors from these places.
Kuana Torres Kahele will perform back-to-back concerts of his Music for the Hawaiian Islands show Sunday, August 7th at Palikū Theater on the Windward Community College campus. The afternoon concert, Music for Hawaii Island and Niihau, is at 2 p.m., and the evening concert, Music for Maui and Kauai, is at 6 p.m.
This week on Bridging the Gap, we're listening to new music and other recent discoveries. We'll hear songs from the Bacal Rhythm and Steel Band, Quantic's Flowering Inferno Project, and Classic High Life out on Soundway Records. I'm Mr. Nick. Join me this Saturday evening from 6 to 8 for Bridging the Gap, here on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Beth Ann Jackie Young gave a very vivid description of emerging from a hospital, as many people do, with a, you know, a prescription in one hand and a sort of a vaguely disoriented feeling, having just had major surgery and being discharged from the hospital, but far from ready to go home and take care of yourself.
Which is, you know, what faces a lot of people if they come here from the neighbor islands to have to
especially,
do that.
Especially, yeah.
And it makes me wonder, too, with, you know, hotel rooms that go wanting on a nightly basis, whether anything is happening through the tourism industry that might make those rooms available to visitors who have to come here who really shouldn't be going directly from hospital right back to the plane.
You know, there's a big gap there. Anyone who's been through it can tell you, I'm sure.
Well, if anybody has an answer to that one, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we have to go along and try to find some more answers for you for what we're going to talk about next week. But I can tell you that we're going to take a look at some of those tight primary races on Maui.
And how a surf photographer creates those spectacular images.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line anytime you like to leave us your comments. That number is 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find our playlist at HawaiiPublicRadio.org on our conversation page, where you can also listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Koslovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants. And our summer intern is Paul Marto Pinto.
The Backyard Quiz theme is written by John DeMello, and I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. See you Monday for more of The Conversation.
Take one multi-Hoku award-winning artist, that's Kuana Torres Kahele, two back-to-back concerts of his Music for the Hawaiian Islands, two Merry Monarch-winning Hula Halau, discount tickets for groups of six or more. This all adds up to a celebration of Hawaii you won't want to miss. For more about this upcoming fundraiser for your public radio station, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/events. I'm Derek Malama of Kanikapula Sunday, and I'll see you there.
You're tuned to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, KIPO Honolulu, KIPM Waikapu, KHBH Kailua Kona, KIPH Hana, KIPO Lihue, and KAHU Pahala, collectively the stations of HBR2. Good morning, it's 9 o'clock in the islands, and Science Friday is next.
From the studios of the City University of New York and PRI, Public Radio International, I'm Ira Flato, and this is Science Friday. Neil Armstrong took mankind's first steps on the moon, but it was computer code written by a woman named Margaret Hamilton that helped save the mission minutes before the lunar module touched down. This hour, the story of the remarkable women who made Apollo 11 and space travel a success. Plus, an atomic abacus that could store the entire Library of Congress in a microscopic cube. Quantum magic makes it possible. And the shocking tale of electric eels. It's all coming up after the break, so stay with us.